This is VOA News. I'm Joe Palca. Pope Francis has made dialogue with Islam one of the cornerstones of his papacy. Since he became pope in 2013, he has visited several countries with large Muslim populations. Now, today, he will become the first pope to go to the Arabian Peninsula when he visits the United Arab Emirates. Sabina Castelfranco has more from Rome.
Pope Francis was invited by Abu Dhabi's Crown Prince Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan to take part in an interfaith conference. The Pope will spend less than 48 hours in the United Arab Emirates and is due to make only two public addresses during the visit. Pope Francis released a video message this week ahead of his visit. He paid tribute to the United Arab Emirates as a land that is trying to be a model of coexistence, of human brotherhood, and a meeting place among diverse civilizations and cultures, where many find a safe place to work and live freely in the respect of diversities. The Pope will celebrate an open-air mass in Abu Dhabi's Zayed Sports City on Tuesday. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News, Rome.
Since his election, the Pope has already visited half a dozen predominantly Muslim nations. He has condemned using violence in the name of God and urged interreligious dialogue. Now, the war in Yemen, in which the UAE is involved as part of a Saudi-led coalition, could cast a shadow on the trip. Salvadorans are going to the polls today to elect a new president. The frontrunner in the race is 37-year-old Nayib Bukele, the former mayor of San Salvador. If Bukele wins, his victory as a member of the Grand Alliance for National Party Unity would usher in a new political landscape. The Central American country has been ruled by just two parties. The new president will take the reins of one of the most violent countries in the world. This is VOA News. Thousands of Venezuelans living in countries across Latin America rallied on Saturday in solidarity with protests organized by the political opposition in Caracas against the government of President Nicolas Maduro. From Bogota to Buenos Aires to Lima, Venezuelans headed to plazas and other public spaces to voice their support for opposition leader and self-declared interim president Juan Guaido and his efforts to force Maduro out of power and bring humanitarian aid into the ailing South American country. Protesters across the region waved Venezuelan flags. The rallies in Latin American capitals coincided with many others held within Venezuela on Saturday. As domestic and international pressure on Maduro to step down mounts, a senior Air Force general disavowed him in a video that circulated earlier on Saturday. Russian President Vladimir Putin announced in a televised address on Saturday that Russia is suspending its participation in the Cold War era intermediate range nuclear forces treaty. AP's Karen Chamas reports.
We will respond quid pro quo, Putin said. Our American partners have announced they were suspending their participation in the treaty, and we will do the same. They have announced they will conduct research and development, and we will act accordingly. President Trump had earlier accused Russia of violating the treaty by developing banned missiles. Moscow has strongly denied any breaches and accused Washington of making false accusations in order to justify its pullout. Trump said in a statement that the U.S. will move forward with developing its own military response options to Russia's deployment of banned cruise missiles that could target Western Europe. I'm Karen Chamas.
President Trump has waded into the controversy surrounding the governor of Virginia over a racist photo that appeared on the governor's medical school yearbook page. President Trump tweeted late Saturday that Governor Ralph Northam's initial apology for the photo and subsequent denial that he was in the picture are quote-unquote unforgivable. The president's tweet also referenced a controversy surrounding comments that Northam made earlier last week about late-term abortion. Now, Northam, a Democrat, quickly apologized on Friday after reports emerged of a photo in his 1984 yearbook page that shows a man in blackface standing next to a member of the Ku Klux Klan. But the following day, amid numerous calls for Northam to resign, the governor held a press conference.
In the hours since I made my statement yesterday, I reflected with my family and classmates from the time and affirmed my conclusion that I am not the person in that photo.
And members of the Democratic Party are joining a chorus to get Northam to resign as governor of Virginia. I'm Joe Palca, VOA News.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington.
Government has done very well in terms of equipping the military and in terms of maintaining what we have, both in terms of physical assets and equipment. So, but we all have to wait for the outcome of the investigation so that we can speak to the facts.
The Nigerian president orders an investigation into the helicopter crash involving Vice President Yemi Osinbajo Saturday.
Various plea bargains entered into by the Anti-Corruption Commission. And President Bio said any recovery made from this commission will go into pro-poor development projects.
The Sierra Leonean Anti-Corruption Commission of Inquiry begins work Monday.
We're sure to get a good number of votes because we know that PP as a party is very popular in the north, is very popular in the east, and I also know that UTM is very popular in towns and among the working class. So you combine those numbers, we're bound to form the next government.
And 9 Malawian opposition parties form an alliance ahead of the May general election. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari has ordered an investigation into the crash landing of the helicopter carrying Vice President Yemi Osinbajo Saturday. The Vice President and 11 others survived the helicopter crash, which occurred in Kaba, Kogi State, where they had traveled as part of the ruling All Progressives Congress or APC campaign ahead of the February 16 general election. Opposition parties, civil society groups and religious organizations expressed shock over the helicopter crash, but thank God for saving the vice president. For more reaction regarding the helicopter accident, I reach Lanre Issa Onilu, National Publicity Secretary for the ruling APC.
I think that's just the normal thing to do. It is important to know what the likely causes are, so that in future we can ensure that such things won't happen again.
The vice president is on record to have said the pilot and the security officials handled it expertly well. Would that be considered as part of the investigation?
Well, the investigators might need an opinion of people who were right inside the chopper when all this was going on. So it may not be part of the investigation, but it is something that would be valuable for investigators to be able to reach a conclusion.
What is your reaction about how political opponents, including the main opposition party and presidential candidate, reacted when they heard of this accident?
Most reactions have been positive. What you expect in a situation like this is for people to band it together and everybody to speak to the fact that we have just been saved from a calamity. And so most reactions were along that line, and we appreciate that. We all need to realize that at the end of the day, this country belongs to all of us, and we all have contributions to make. And when something negative happens to one, it happens to all. It's what APC is all about.
Will the vice president continue the election campaign as the APC has tabled its campaign plan despite the accident?
That question was answered immediately. Nothing changed. It came out from the chopper, and they continue with the program they had for the day. So if they did that, it means that the other programs continue. We have a country to run. And then we can not run away because such an incident happened.
Larry, some Nigerians that I spoke with earlier on said there's need for the vehicles or the aircraft carrying the president and important officials, including the vice president, to be thoroughly maintained because they worry that because of the ongoing fight against Boko Haram, and because some military officials have expressed concern about the lack of equipment, this could be as a result of that. Some people dismiss it as just an unfortunate accident. But what is your take about this concern?
I think that would be speculative to conclude that certain factors were responsible for what has happened. Accidents happen on the roads, in the sea, in the air, anywhere in the world, in the most advanced nation. Brand new aircraft could have issues. So this is just normal. It is technology. So, and it's not right for us to reach conclusions and not making pronouncements on an issue that we have not seen the result of the investigation. And again, to talk about the lack of equipment, I don't think anybody saying lack of equipment now would be right to say so. You could say this before this government came on board. This government has done so very well in terms of, clearly, in terms of keeping the military. We know that things are by far better than what it used to be. The military is very well equipped now, and that's why they're able to respond to the injustice project. And that's why Abuja is safer, that's why Yobe is safer, that's why Adamawa is safer, that's why Kogi State is safer. These are used to be hot spots, and where you had insecurity, you know, before this government came on board. So now you have people are moving freely in these states, even in Borno State, where you have, which is the hotbed of two-thirds of Borno is completely safe. They were those that have issues of intermittent attack, otherwise it's also safe. So people are responding to it, and I think nowhere in the world would you wipe off insurgents in just a number of 2-3 years. America has been fighting in Afghanistan, in Syria, in Yemen, in many countries where there is such a situation. Up to now, they are still there. So it's not something that you just wipe out just within 1-2 years. So by now, they are large. They are very well. This government has done very well in terms of equipping the military and in terms of maintaining what we have, both in terms of physical assets and equipment. So, but we all have to wait for the outcome of the investigation so that we can speak to the facts.
Marlon Larry Issa Onilu is the National Publicity Secretary for the Nigerian ruling APC. He spoke with me from the capital, Abuja. Meanwhile, the Nigerian government in 2001 pledged, along with all African countries, to set aside 15% of its annual budget for healthcare spending. But the country has yet to come close to reaching that goal. The result is that up to 70% of medical spending is out of pocket, forcing many of those with sudden health problems into debt, poverty, or an early grave. For VOA, Timothy Obiezu reports from the Nigerian capital, Abuja.
Ajayi Taiwo was involved in a car wreck a year ago that injured his right leg and pelvis 3 weeks before his wedding. Today, he's still recovering.
I actually spent like close to two months in the hospital. And all the resources that we have gathered together for the wedding to make it good actually went into hospital bills.
The government hospital where Taiwo was taken would not grant him discounts promised under Nigeria's national health care plan. So he had to sell his car and other valuables just to pay for care.
Imagine I went to a government hospital and I was paying heavily as if I was in a private hospital.
In 2001, Nigeria, along with all African Union countries, pledged to spend 15% of its annual budget for health care, the so-called Abuja Declaration. But 18 years later, Nigeria's highest ever budget share for healthcare was just 7%. Last year, it dropped to less than 4%. The impact is that 70% of hospital spending in Nigeria is out of pocket, pushing Nigerians like Ajayi into debt or poverty.
Having to pay out of pocket is a huge, huge devastating effect on any family. I mean, you've got to look out for food, first of all, for the family, school fees, and other things, just basic things to live. And that's why you find that a lot of people that end up in hospitals come only when it is late, simply because they don't have the funds.
Neka Oji is a financial officer in Nigeria's Ministry of Health. She explains that the government is partnering with international and private affiliates to make healthcare more affordable.
Our out-of-pocket health expenditure was estimated at over 70%. And even the estimate we have for 2017 is even higher. So our goal is to use the strategy from the basket funding and making sure we have a basic minimum package of care to reduce the high out-of-pocket expenditure.
But until Nigeria dramatically increases its healthcare budget, patients like Tai will likely face a struggle to stay healthy. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja.
This
Sierra Leonean Commission of Inquiry is scheduled to begin working Monday. The commission, which comprises three judges from Sierra Leone, Nigeria and Ghana, was sworn in last week by President Julius Maada Bio. The commission is tasked to investigate allegations of corruption in state institutions and officials accused of financial malfeasance. But the main opposition All People's Congress, or APC, says it will not cooperate with the commission, contending that it is aimed to persecute its members. To learn more about the work of the Commission of Inquiry, I reach Mohamed Rado Soare, the Sierra Leonean Information Minister.
President Bio officially swore in the three judges of the commissions. In his address today, he enjoined them to dispense justice without fear and favor, just to ensure that at the end of the day, the ends of justice are met. He assured them that he will not interfere into the process so that the commissions will rise above board, will be free, credible, and, you know, satisfy every party, even those who have questioned its neutrality. So the commission has a grand appeal for all facets of society. During the ceremony, the Attorney General Minister of Justice, for the very first time, made it public. She cited various provisions in the Constitution to support the position that calls for a court committee to legislate specific legislation for the commissions does not have a place in this, because various commissions have been held even in pre-colonial times to the end of the tenure of President Nkrumah.
Those in the opposition parties are saying that the commission will be used to persecute them, and as such, they are planning not to submit or not to work with the commission. How does this commission work independently if a political party feels that it is going to be persecuted by a government institution established to investigate when the party was in government?
President Bio has been clear and categorical. This commission is not putting the APC on trial. It's not about tribes, it's not about regions, it's not about political parties. This commission is a clarion call for citizens who have had the opportunity to serve either as president, vice president, heads of departments, to come forward and give account of their stewardship. So this is not targeting any political party. So we are not talking to the APC, we are talking about people who have had the opportunity to lead our great nation. So, I mean, the president has no interest in tinkering with the judicial process. The attorney general, the chief justice, made the same appeals. They made the same clarifications during the session. So nobody is out to persecute anybody. This is a judicial inquiry. At the end of the investigations, a report will be presented to His Excellency. Anybody feels an adverse verdict has been reached, they are not comfortable with, they have recourse to appeal to higher courts. So I don't understand why all this huffing and puffing.
The APC also cited questions the Sierra Leonean Bar Association raised, saying that there are certain grey areas that could be exploited by the government against the opposition. How do you respond to that?
It's very simple. I mean, the Bar Association contends that there has to be rules of evidence set up by the court committee. So, I mean, the Attorney General spoke very eloquently to that. The Attorney General reiterated that and said the commission was fit and properly seated to carry out its mandate, right? So the Bar Association really did not have a case.
What is the time frame for this commission, and what do you think are the expectations of Sierra Leoneans as this commission begins its work officially on Monday?
Well, studies have been done by various think tanks in Sierra Leone. There's an independent think tank here, Institute for Governance Reform. They did a perception survey, and 81% of Sierra Leoneans resoundingly support the commissions of inquiry. Even in the heartland of Bombali district, where the former president hails from, 68.3% of Sierra Leoneans there support the commissions of inquiry. So this is a hugely popular commission of inquiry, particularly coming hot on the heels of the presentation of 8.4 billion leones to President Bio as proceeds of corruption, various plea bargains entered into by the Anti-Corruption Commission. And President Bio said any recoveries made from these commissions will go into pro-poor development projects.
The opposition APC said they will not cooperate with the commission until their concerns are addressed. Has the government addressed their concerns to ensure transparency, fairness, as you described?
Those concerns are not valid. They are not legitimate. The Attorney General and the Chief Justice adequately debunked them at the launch of the Commissions of Inquiry yesterday at the precincts of the Special Court. So that's no longer an argument. It has been laid to rest. But the fact of the matter remains, President Bio is not out to witch hunt anybody. He does not need to do that, because even at the peak of the APC in power, they were still beating at the polls. That is why he has said the commissions will not end, they will not last a lifetime, they will last between 3 to 6 months, hoping that those of interest to the commissions will cooperate fully. But that's the point.
Mohamed Rado Soare is the Sierra Leonean Information Minister. He spoke with me from the capital, Freetown. Nine Malawian opposition leaders have agreed to form an alliance in the run-up to the upcoming May elections. They include former President Joyce Banda from the People's Party, or PP, and former Vice President Kassim Chilumba, leader of the Assembly for Democracy and Development, or ADD. They formed the alliance with embattled Vice President Dr. Saulos Chilima from the UTM Party. But the ruling party rejected the prospects of the alliance, saying it is unfazed by what it described as a combination of nuisance. For more about the alliance, I reach parliamentarian Noah Chimpeni, spokesman for the Opposition People's Party, or PP.
Yeah, what led the alliance is the general feeling in the country that at least people say that no one party can win on its own. Therefore, there's need for parties to work together, especially opposition parties. So that's why we find ourselves having an alliance with UTM.
Does that mean that Joyce Banda will not stand as the presidential candidate for the PP party and will endorse or has endorsed UTM presidential candidate?
No, what will happen is they haven't chosen the presidential candidate yet. That one will be decided on Monday. But our president has said that if it's somebody else to lead, then she's okay with it, because by the end of the day, it's Malawians that matter. That's according to her. So she's okay not to lead. She's also okay to lead.
What is the prospect of this alliance, if I may ask you?
The prospects are very good. With the two parties now, we are geared to form the next government. Of course, there are also other parties, smaller parties, who have joined. So once we work hard from now to election day, I mean, we're sure to carry the day.
President Mutharika's ruling DPP is saying that this is just a noisy or nuisance of an alliance, and they are not bothered by it because of the power of incumbency, some suggest, because of the popularity of President Professor Atapita Mutharika. What is your take?
What popularity is he talking about? If he's not worried, why talk about something that does not bother you? By the way, the same DPP, they were also looking for PP to work with them. And I know that they're also quoting another party. They've been in alliance with UDF all along. So what is he talking about that he's not bothered? To tell you the fact, I think he's very worried about this alliance.
Why should he be worried about this alliance? He has the power of incumbency. Some also suggest that the state resources are at his disposal, as well as the ruling party. Why should he be bothered about an alliance of a fractious opposition alliance, they said, which is noisy and a nuisance?
He has to be very worried. He has to be very worried because there is stress in unity. And again, it's very unpopular in the country. Therefore, two strong opposition parties coming together, he's bound to be worried, and very worried for that matter.
Some analysts are saying your alliance as an opposition party, as well as the strength of the MCP led by Lazarus Chakwera, could split the front of the opposition and allow President Atapita Mutharika to win re-election. What is your take on that?
That cannot happen because of the way people vote in this country. You know, it's not it's first past the post. You are one can win, can be president with one vote. So we're sure to get a good number of votes, because we know that PP as a party is very popular in the north, is very popular in the east, and I also know that UTM is very popular in towns and among the working class. So you combine those numbers, we are bound to form the next government.
What makes you so confident? Because some suggest that although people vote on ethnic lines, things might change in this election.
No, what makes me very confident is because people are so tired with this government, they won't change. And the message from Joyce Banda and the message from Chilima has been more or less the same. That I'm trying to redeem Malawian from the sufferings that are going through under DPP. So that makes me very confident that the talk in town and in the rural areas, people are very tired of the DPP government.
But I understand the DPP is very popular in the south
and very popular in the rural areas because they tend to have pro-poor policies. Why do you deny that?
Of course, they'll get some votes in the South, but also this alliance will get some votes in the South. And MCB also has made significant inroads in the South, the same South. So therefore, the South is no longer, exclusively the domain of the DPP.
So what is the message here to the people of Malawi in this alliance ahead of the elections?
The message is that now the hope they have been waiting for is here. Come, they should turn up in the right numbers on 20 May to go and vote so that things change for the better in this country. That's the message.
Parliamentarian Noah Chimpeni is the spokesman for the Malawian Opposition People's Party, or PP. He spoke with me from the commercial capital, Blantyre. In advance of World Cancer Day Monday, the World Health Organization is issuing new cancer pain control guidelines aimed at ending the needless suffering experienced by millions of people afflicted with this illness. For VOA, Lisa Schlein has more from Geneva.
Cancer is a leading cause of death globally. The World Health Organization reports there are more than 18 million new cases every year and 9.6 million deaths, most in low or middle-income countries. Great advances have been made in the treatment of cancer, but measures to relieve the horrific pain experienced by patients lag woefully behind. WHO hopes to remedy this with its new guidance on pain management. Director of WHO's Department for the Management of Non-Communicable Diseases, Etienne Krug, says controlling pain should be an essential part of cancer treatment. Yet, he says, pain is very often neglected as part of that treatment, a situation he considers unacceptable.
Nobody, cancer patients or not cancer patients, should live or die in pain in the 21st century. We have the knowledge of how to treat pain. We have the medicines of how to address it. It's a question of making sure everybody has that knowledge and everybody has access to the necessary treatment.
Kirk says the situation is most acute in the poorer countries because pain management systems tend not to be in place. But he notes even in the rich countries, people are still living and dying in pain. WHO says opioid painkillers like oral morphine are an essential treatment for moderate to severe cancer pain. But WHO non-communicable coordinator Sheriana Varghese says some governments have enacted regulatory and legal barriers against their use in reaction to the global scare of opioid and morphine addiction.
When a government of a country wants to introduce opioids, there is always this looming danger that this is going to get out of hand. And so the governments are more conservative because of this.
Varghese says there are sufficient safeguards against the abuse of opioids and morphine. He says these painkillers should be given only by trained healthcare providers, doctors and nurses. He adds oral preparation should be given whenever possible to prevent addiction. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Hello, this is Peter Clotty of VOA Africa. I will be in Nigeria starting February 6th to cover the general election. Listen to my daily report when you tune in to our news shows, Africa News Tonight, Daybreak Africa, Nightline Africa, and International Edition for the latest from Lagos.
Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in, feast your ears, and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Saturday and Sunday at 1500 and 2000 UTC.
the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington, coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Impuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under-Secretary General for Political Affairs. But first, Australian mining giants Rio Tinto and BHP are supporting greater Indigenous recognition in Parliament. BHP Chief Executive Andrew Mackenzie said the company, like the nation as a whole, has unfinished business with the Indigenous peoples of Australia and that it cannot stand on the sidelines. Critics, however, believe it could be a cynical move by the mining sector to gain favour with tribal groups which have land rich in natural resources. For VOA, Philip Mercer reports from Sydney.
BHP and Rio Tinto are supporting a campaign to change Australia's constitution to give a formal voice to Aboriginal people in federal parliament. The mining giants employ thousands of Indigenous workers and are backing a demand from community leaders called the Uluru Statement from the Heart, made in 2017, for a special Aboriginal body to advise Parliament. BHP Chief Executive Officer Andrew Mackenzie said the reform would empower Indigenous people and would boost the reconciliation process.
We now have a chance to create a new chapter in our history, to create a voice that will establish a bridge across that gulf. Now, I know there are fears that a constitutionally enshrined voice, confirmed by referendum, will deepen cultural divisions and is undemocratic. I don't think those fears stand up to scrutiny.
BHP will contribute about $700,000 to a project raising awareness about the benefits of an Indigenous voice to the Australian Parliament. Many of the company's operations are located on or close to Indigenous land. BHP says it acknowledges the right of First Australians to maintain their culture, identity, traditions and customs. But there is scepticism about the company's motives. Jacinta Price, an Aboriginal councillor in the central Australian city of Alice Springs, believes the miners' support for constitutional reform is a superficial move.
We need to have a bit more of a discussion. I don't know that just simply throwing your support behind something that we're not sure what that actually looks like is helpful. And in a way, perhaps it is a way of these companies to look better in the eyes of Indigenous people, considering it's Indigenous people's land that, you know, they want to be involved in.
Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison has rejected the mining giant's push for greater Indigenous rights in federal parliament. He said he was focused on practical measures to help Aboriginal communities. Indigenous people make up about 3% of the population, but suffer high rates of poverty, ill health and imprisonment. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Impuga. Hello, Douglas.
Hi, Peter, and good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. The 2019 Africa Cup of Nations has been delayed to allow players to rest after the Muslim holy month of Ramadan. The four-week-long event will now kick off on June 21st, with the final set for July 19th instead of June 15th to July 13th. The change was announced by tournament director and former Egypt international Mohamed Fadler. He said the decision was taken following requests from Morocco, Tunisia and Algeria, who want their players to have time to rest after Ramadan. The Confederation of African Football has also confirmed the draw for the final will be on April 12th. Ramadan, when Muslims abstain from food and water from sunrise sunset, is due to start at the beginning of May until the beginning of June. The 2019 Africa Cup of Nations will, for the first time this year, take place in the summer and feature 24 teams rather than 16. Egypt were chosen to host the tournament, replacing Cameroon, who were stripped of the hosting rights due to slow preparations and security concerns. Meanwhile, the Confederation of African Football, CAF, says Ivory Coast has agreed to host the 2023 Africa Cup of Nations instead of 2021. The move allows Cameroon, who were stripped of the right to stage this year's event, to take on 2021 instead. Ivory Coast had resisted the two-year delay going as far as filing a case to the Court of Arbitration for Sport. But after President Alassane Ouattara met CAF President Ahmed on Tuesday, a deal has been sealed. Guinea, who had been selected for 2023, will put on the 2025 tournament. Both Cameroon and Guinea had already agreed to the changes, so the deal with Ivory Coast is the final part of the reorganization of CAF's long-standing plans. In another development, the Comoros Football Federation, FFC, has lodged a case at the Court of Arbitration for Sport over Cameroon's participation at the 2019 Africa Cup of Nations. According to a post on social media from the general manager of the Comoros team, Ben Amil Sadi, the Comoros believe that Cameroon should be excluded from the 2019 finals after having the hosting rights for the tournament withdrawn from them. Comoros are in the same qualifying group as Cameroon, whom they face in March. The FFC claim that CAF has failed to implement its own regulations concerning the action to be taken. CAF rules state that if a nation withdraws from hosting or has the rights taken away 1 year from before the finals, that state faces a fine of $500,000 and a suspension of the next edition of the Africa Cup of Nations. As things stand, the Nations Cup qualifying match between Cameroon and the Comoros will decide who joins already qualified Morocco in reaching the finals in Egypt, with the fourth team in Group B, Malawi, no longer able to go through. With Morocco on 10 points, Cameroon 8, and the Comoros 5, a draw in Cameroon will be enough for the Indomitable Lions to advance, while the Comoros must win to advance. Finally, in boxing, a rematch between Deontay Wilder and Tyson Fury seems certain. The pair fought a controversial draw in Los Angeles in December, with many people believing 30-year-old Fury had won despite being knocked down twice. The 33-year American Wilder said it's going to be done, it's just a matter of time, adding it's not if it happens, it's when it happens, and we are looking at late April or early May. The original fight was scored 115 to 111 for Wilder, 114 to 112 for Fury, and 113-113, with Fury's second knockdown in the 12th round proving crucial. The draw was the first time either man had not been victorious in a professional fight, after Wilder had won his first 40 contests and Fury had won his previous 27 bouts. For Fury, it was his first title matchup since he beat Vladimir Klitschko for the IBF, IBO, WBA, and WBO belts in 2015, before he was out of boxing for more than 2 years. Wilder also said a rematch with Fury would take place either in Las Vegas or the Barclays Center in New York. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Back to you, Peter.
As always, thanks a lot, Douglas. It's a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African Sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And it's Sunday on Nightline Africa. This is the time we get to relax and reflect, a flashback with music from the continent. You are hearing a Pato Ranking featuring Diamond Platnumz with Love You Die. He will be followed by Simi Loving, and then Benda with Muna Kampala, and then we end with Saida Karoli with Maria Salome.
I love you. poverty. We get the mansions and property. For your baby stand properly. They must play this one for every party. You. Them they talk say I no go school. Them they talk say I they follow you. Some people say I they bobo you. But you love the way I combo you. Oh. Win, win, win.
namulabila kutele nankubisa kelele ntambuza kanyegenyege wagana nja kumilembeke superstar bichi movie star bichi
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa here at the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under-Secretary General for Political Affairs. Hello, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. The International Criminal Court at The Hague, ICC, is still complicating the lives and fortunes of many high-profile Africans. On 15th January this year, a five-panel of judges in a 3-2 decision cleared former president of La Côte d'Ivoire, Laurence Gbagbo, and his deputy, Charles Blaise Goudé, of all crimes filed against them by the ICC prosecutors. The majority ruling of the court stated that the prosecutors failed to connect Mr. Gbagbo with the crimes committed in the post-election violence in La Côte d'Ivoire. They were ordered to be released immediately. But the chief prosecutor of the ICC, Fatou Bensouda, immediately objected to their release on the grounds that she intended to appeal the ruling of the court. As a result, they were kept in custody for 2 weeks until the 1st of February. Now, the court has agreed to release Gbagbo on conditions. One of the conditions is that a country must guarantee that Gbagbo will be brought before the court in the case of the appeal. It was clear, however, that the prosecutor was objecting to Gbagbo returning to La Côte d'Ivoire at this time. The reason given was that previously the ICC had failed to get the government of La Côte d'Ivoire to send the wife of Laurence Gbagbo, Simone Gbagbo, to The Hague, even though there was an arrest warrant. The condition set by the court is that Gbagbo should be in a country not too far from his headquarters in the Netherlands, and that country must be a member of the ICC. This restricted the number of countries to maybe 3 countries, France, Belgium, or Germany. No one knows yet which of these countries would assume the responsibility set by the courts. But there are greater issues to be tackled now. Mr. Gbagbo had been detained for 7 years in The Hague, and now that he has been declared not guilty, these are 7 wasted years. It is important that the ICC find another means by which it could detain individuals. For example, in the case of Kenya in 2014, arrangements were made for both the president of Kenya and his deputy, Ruto, to remain in Kenya and to appear before The Hague when they are required. Of course, the conditions were different from that of La Côte d'Ivoire, which had a very violent conflict resulting in 3,000 deaths. And the new president, Mr. Ouattara, did hand him over to the ICC. Also, in Kenya, the president of Kenya and his vice president did not contest the jurisdiction of the courts. There is also now this new procedure that those who have been detained could be in countries near The Hague. So these are 2 things which may be considered by the ICC in the future. But there is another problem, and one which was experienced by Mr. Jean-Pierre Pemba. Mr. Jean-Pierre Pemba was also released by the ICC, but he went to Belgium. But when he tried to run for president in the DRC in the last election in December, both the Electoral Commission and the Constitutional Court refused to allow him to contest on the grounds that he had been charged or sentenced for tampering with witness. So these are the things which should be looked at carefully by the ICC in the future, because it is not acceptable that someone should wait for 7 years in custody and in the end to be told that he is not guilty. Also, in La Côte d'Ivoire, ardent supporters of Mr. Babo have been returning jubilantly to Abidjan to await the return of the leader. They will be disappointed. So these are matters which will need further reconsideration. But finally, this is not the first time that the court has criticized what some lawyers have called sloppy prosecution. That too needs to be examined. I thank you.
That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under-Secretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we're on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Saleh, reporter Douglas Impuga, producer Saida Hamdoun, and our engineer for today, the ever-friendly Nelson Lopez. We say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, a family name is not cooked and eaten. One's life is the thing. I'm your host, Peter Clotte in Washington. Good evening, Africa.